On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we're on the payroll of Henry VIII in Shardlake on Disney Plus, defecting from behind the Iron Curtain in Cold War espionage thriller Spymaster on BBC Four, and we're back on the night shift with Martin Freeman in the second series of The Responder on BBC One. And if that's not enough, The Responder himself, Mr. Martin Freeman, along with the creator of the show, Tony Schumacher, join us on this week's show to chat Scouse law enforcement with Boydie. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, your essential guide to every show that matters, here to help you navigate the increasingly choppy waters of peak TV. And with me on this voyage, as you would hope, are my two trusty co-pilots, newly minted Reddit enthusiast, Kay Rivero, and former Silver Service star, Boyd Hilton.
True. Yes, you are referring to the, what's it called? AMA, Ask Me Anything?
Indeed, on the Reddit, yes, on the Reddit.
That we did this week, and I revealed that I once burnt someone's arm with when I was doing civil service waitering in Brighton, in the hotel. I think it was the Metropole Hotel, yeah.
How long did you last?
Oh, like a couple of weeks, I think.
Were you fired or did you quit?
I think I quit. Yeah, found something slightly better to do, whatever that was, I can't remember. Yeah.
Actually, I wanted to bring up the Ask Me Anything. No, Ask Me Anything? Yeah, that's it. Mm. Ask Me Anything. Because after we did that, so we did it during our lunch hour, and then in the evening I got an email from one of our colleagues, a new friend to the pod, who got in touch to say, actually, she was in the canteen. We did it in the canteen where we work. We call it canteen. There's no food supplied there.
No, it's just a load of tables.
And she was sitting nearby, apparently, and she's a long-term listener. Her name is Michelle McKay, and she's been a fan of the pod since 2019 when she was on mat leave. But anyway, she said it's her favourite pod of all time ever. She subscribes as well. She's a proper, aficionado. Anyway, do you know how she knew that we were nearby? Because she hadn't spotted us. Do you know how she knew, James?
How?
She heard you doing your Liverpudlian accent.
Oh, my God.
And then when she looked up, she realised it was us. And
she thought, who's that twat?
And do you know why he was doing that? It's because in between us replying to the questions, I said to him, oh, what are we doing? What are we recording today? What are we doing? And then he did his awful Liverpudlian accent. Actually, it's not too bad.
This was me doing my sort of like
Martin
Peter
Freeman.
Serafinowicz.
Mm.
Be a fucking chicken.
He was doing that repeatedly at me until I was like, oh, right, yeah, we're doing Responder. And I didn't know anyone else was listening. But yeah, that's how she knew
wow.
we were nearby. Anyway, she said she's a big fan. She's based in Glasgow. She very much enjoys when you do the accent because it's by far your worst, but it makes her laugh a lot. So I thought you could say thanks for listening in your awful Glaswegian accent.
I can't. I've got performance anxiety now. I can't
on.
Do it on request.
Do it for Michelle. It has to
come bubbling to
well,
the surface organically. No, that was my Scouse accent, though I can understand the confusion.
What's the accent?
I know they're very similar.
Glasgow.
See, I love the way that also you're saying Glaswegian as if my quote-unquote Scottish accent has any kind of locale to it, as if it's like targeted to any specific
locale.
Part of the country.
Locale. What is that locale of which you speak?
What would you have me say,
well,
Kay?
I think, well, when someone writes in saying that they've been listening for 5 years, and also, this is how well she knows me. She said, it's my fave podcast of all time ever, and yes, I have left a 5-star review. So I think you should just say thank you.
The most, I'd probably end up quoting something from like a dwarf in World of Warcraft, because for some reason, it's a video game where all the dwarves, and this is quite a common thing in gaming, that dwarves are Scottish. It's unclear why.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know why.
The terrible Lord of the Rings thing on Prime Video. They had all the...
Hang on. By terrible Lord of the Rings thing, just to be clear, you mean the Lord of the Rings of Power, the
yeah.
most expensive TV
yeah.
show ever made.
Exactly.
That's the one you
That's
mean.
That's the one. Oh, okay. The very same.
Okay.
All, one of the people, they also had a different accent. Was it Scottish or Welsh or Irish? All of the
oh,
elves
look,
or whatever they were.
They all sound the same to him.
Yeah. But that was, I was like, why have they all got that Celtic, whatever
I think
it was.
I think it's just to try and, you know, give the hint of dialects to them.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I feel
mine.
That's the influence on you because you're such a Lord of the Rings obsessive.
So channel that.
channel that into my Scottish accent. No, that's, I can't do it.
Anyway.
Oh, yeah, by the hearth.
Okay.
That's about as far as it goes.
Wow. Michelle, that one was just for you.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry,
anyway,
Michelle.
Anyway, thank you for listening and for leaving the review and getting in touch.
I don't even know where we were. So what have we been watching? There we go. We should start with that.
So I have finished Shogun.
You and everyone else because it ended this week.
I know, and it's devastating that it's over, but also just spectacular. It was just beautiful in every sense. The storytelling, performances, direction, blah, blah, blah. We're going to do a spoiler special.
We are. Tell me, Boydie, what did you think of the finale?
Well, you're being smug, but actually...
Yeah, you are being smug.
You have not caught up.
Yes.
I have.
Have you?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to leave it for the big surprise, you know, reveal in my... version of the What Have You Been Watching segment, but you, since you've brought up in your
being a smug twat, yes,
typically smug way, yeah. I have finished it.
That's impressive, because you were way behind.
Yeah, that's the commitment. That's the level of professionalism and commitment I have to this podcast, James.
He walked into the office this morning watching it on his phone.
Yeah. As the creators intended.
Yeah.
Well, listen, oh my God. Listen, you can't complain.
Are you daring?
Do you know what? I have to defend Boydo in that instance, because he's bloody watched it.
Yeah. No, fair play. And you know, without any spoilers, because we'll save that for the spoiler special, what do we think? How did you react to the finale? What did you know?
Well, it's brilliant. Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal. Well, it's episode 9. It's the penultimate that is the spectacular, incredibly tense and emotional episode, right? And then 10 is kind of a bit more, not, it's kind of like an aftermath episode in a way, isn't it? But brilliant and quite right, and kind of fitting in with the whole kind of tenor of the series. Yeah,
and that last scene I thought was perfect.
Yeah.
But anyway.
To be discussed in detail on a forthcoming spoiler special. But yeah, okay, good stuff. What else have you been watching?
I watched all of Baby Reindeer. So I finally caught up on that. I was dragging my heels a little bit because I knew what was coming with episode 4 because I heard so many people talk about it. But yeah, I finished that. And it is extraordinary. The story is extraordinary. He's incredibly brave for, you know, talking about the abuse and trauma and for playing himself. But I just feel still so uncomfortable about it when I finished watching it, just because of the fact that, and I don't know what went into, you know, the level of permission seeking and discussing it with the, because it's his story and it's her story as well, right? Wrapped into one in a way. And I just wonder if she was consulted before this, because she's now been thrust into the limelight. And no matter how many people say, the makers, he says, you know, like, oh, don't research, don't look her up. She's out there now. Everyone knows who it is. And I just wonder.
Do they know who it is?
Yeah. A lot of people have.
I mean, they think they know who it is.
I think it's highly likely.
I don't think it's the case that she has been involved in any way. In
which case, I just feel a bit uncomfortable, because she's so clearly mentally unwell as she is portrayed in the show. I just wonder the impact it's going to have with so many people knowing that story. And
of course, I mean, it's 100% valid observation to make and to query. But it is what's interesting is this, like many, many shows before it, Baby Reindeer is going through the kind of different phases because it's so big. I mean, if it hadn't been such a hit, I think it's globally number one now on Netflix, which is incredible for a fairly, you know, within Netflix's normal scheme of things, you're a fairly intimate British show, right? It's like number one rant globally. But I don't think he ever thought, and I'm not sure if they ever thought that it would be such a huge phenomenon. Maybe they did because the script is so fantastic. But for it to say so boldly, it's based on a true story. Not even, I think it literally just says that. There's no, you know, couching it in any, you know, some scenes have been created, but all that stuff that you normally get. You know, and then, so it's now going to the point where initially it was like everyone saying how brilliant it was as a show, like we did, I think, when we reviewed it last week, all of us, did we? I think we all really appreciated how brilliant it was. It's now going through the, oh, wait a minute, it's based on a true story. Is it completely all true? Is it embellished? Is there, you know, does he have tacit permission from this real-life version of the person he's depicted? Oh, clearly, seemingly not. That, did he not expect that people would try and find the real person? And people, in fact, involved, the other person involved in his storyline about his trauma,
that's the bit I struggle with, because of course he must... I would imagine, like, if it was me, I would definitely think that people would, because I mean, look, the Royals doctor photo and look how much speculation goes on.
Of course,
that.
But it almost feels weird. I mean, but I've read a couple of think pieces in the papers. There's one in the iPaper today by Julia Rayside, who had actually been on this podcast a couple of years ago. Brilliant TV writer, calling into question the thing quite boldly, quite, and she's got a lot of really good points to make. So I think it's kind of getting, it's a new phase in the show's history, if you like, where now people are being quite like, oh, I feel like, oh, you know, I really, really, I thought it was absolutely brilliant piece of work, brilliantly acted, created, directed, etc., and fascinating and riveting and all that. But now I feel like slightly guilty because of all these other ramifications and all that. It's very interesting. It's a phenomenon. Books will be
written. It's almost like the psychology of watching it.
Yeah, yeah.
As well.
But I do find it, I do find it extraordinary that they don't see, who knows? They don't seem to have anticipated the extent to which the real life versions of the people that he has based this show on are people are trying to find out who they really are.
They probably didn't anticipate the degree to which this would hit.
Right, that's what I think.
And
I agree,
that it would become like a part of a conversation. Certainly in this country, I don't know how much it is abroad, but certainly in the UK, this is the thing that people are talking about at the moment. So, I mean, on the one hand, hooray, but on the other hand, he's probably thinking, oh, shit, you know.
I think so.
Mm.
And finally, to balance that all out, don't look at my... Look, boy's cheating. Stop looking at my list.
You could put your... laptop on the other side, mate. I can't see now. Good. Cheating.
I balanced that out with watching Bluey.
Oh,
yes,
God.
I did it.
No. You couldn't resist it.
The special or just a normal episode?
So I watched the special, the finale, and then they did an extra episode afterwards. So I watched both of them because so many people had got in touch to say, like, we've got to watch it. It was a really great episode. And I have to say, I really did enjoy it. And I actually enjoyed the bonus, like the, so one was like, I think, was it 20 minutes, a bit longer? And then there was an 8 minute ones, 8 minute episode afterwards. And I really enjoyed that. I thought they were fun. They were funny, poignant, and sweet.
Is this the end of Bluey? I heard a rumor this week that Bluey was
starting.
Yeah, you spread it,
I spread it within this podcast. Yeah. I read it literally on Reddit. So whether or not that's true or not.
I don't think that's been confirmed by anyone.
Yeah. So. Maybe rumors of Bluey's demise has been greatly exaggerated.
So. Yeah.
But yeah. Oh, I can confirm it's good.
Now.
Yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And that's me done. Shogun, Baby Reindeer, and Bluey.
Well, two of those. Actually, Baby Reindeer I had finished, but as previously mentioned, because I'm so good, I watched all of Shogun, caught up all of Shogun in the last basically 3 days.
But it's not hard work, is it? It's a joy.
Oh, it's not it's an absolutely brilliant series.
It's not a chore.
It's going to be up there. It will be up there with the top. In the top five, mm-hmm. I would say, at the end of the year, pretty strongly. James, you're looking.
Hey, I've already
refusing
declared
to
it.
Commit.
It's my show of the year so
your
far.
Show of the year, number one.
It may get unseated, but at present, it's a top.
Do you know what? I'm kind of veering towards where James is.
Janie's fully on board. Janie was on board. To be fair, James was on board. He watched the whole. You watched the whole thing like weeks before we even thought
before
about
it.
Before it even been made.
Yeah, before it had been made, I'd seen the whole thing. That's right.
So that's that Shogun. Yes, we will be doing the Spotter Special podcast eventually.
And if anyone disagrees, by the way, if anyone's supposed to say, oh, I don't think it was that good, my answer would just be yes, because you didn't see it with the proper subtitles.
I mean, the subtitles,
James.
Don't want to bang on about them. I know we've rarely mentioned it, but the subtitles are tiny.
Oh my God, so low down.
On the Disney Plus.
On the final Disney Plus. They're bigger. Do you know what? Part of the reason this is absolutely true that I downloaded it to my
because they're bigger on your phone.
They're bigger on the phone.
That is actually true.
It's
yes.
really ridiculous
I noticed
how
that.
Small they are on TV.
Yeah.
You have to, it's like eye strain.
Yeah.
You have to strain your eyes. Anyway.
I didn't even find it small. It was just the positioning. And that's
it's the size.
It's size as well, but it is positioned. They're low down as opposed to sort of very close to the centre of the screen where they're supposed to be. We have discussed this at length. I will say one other thing that has made this hit home is one of the shows that we are reviewing this week is heavily subtitled.
Yes.
And the subtitles are massive.
Yeah, completely. But rather that than the eye strain.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, Shogun. As we speak, I've got hard out. We're recording this, listeners, on Thursday. It's currently 16:31, 2024, the 25th of April. This evening is the Doctor Who screening, the premiere of the new season of Doctor Who, which they're calling season one of the starting a whole new start.
Yeah,
it's a whole new start.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, there was classic Who, there was new Who, which Russell T. Davies revived famously.
And this is You Who?
This is one, no, this is Doctor Who season one. We're starting all over again, effectively. Yeah, I mean, basically, it's Shute's first episodes as opposed to the Christmas special and the regeneration episode before the end of last year. This is his first series proper. They're showing the first two episodes. The first episode is called Space Babies, which is literally about babies in space. And the second episode is called The Devil's Chord, which is about the Beatles.
Mm.
And I've seen one of these. I've seen Space Babies already, so I've mentioned it in my Empire feature interview.
Which I read last night and it's very good.
Oh, thanks, Kate. Mm. Thank you. But the Beatles one, if you'd have said, what's the most exciting thing you could do in Doctor Who? And it's been going for fucking 60 years. I'd be like, well, do an episode with the Beatles, obviously. And he has, and they have. And I cannot wait. I'm so excited about that because I love the Beatles. So as we speak, I haven't seen it yet, but I will have seen it. I will be in my watching section. Listeners, imagine by the time this comes out.
Oh, spoiler alert.
On Monday. Yeah. I mean, obviously can't review them anyway, and they'll be on actual television May 11th. 1 minute past midnight, May the 11th, Disney BBC iPlayer. Yeah. Anyway, there's that. Do you know what? I'm finally, if I want to watch it, I thought, because I always forget what I've actually been watching. So I thought, at the beginning of the week, I thought, do you know what I'm going to do? Because I go home and switch to TV and I actually do watch TV. I thought, I'll just make a note of what I actually have been watching.
On a piece of paper?
Things like things that I always watch, which I've mentioned before, like, you know, The Chase. You know I watch The Chase, because sometimes you call me between 5 and 6 and it's infuriating.
During work hours, by the way.
During work hours, yeah. But I'm still working. I'm just multitasking when The Chase is on. This morning, stuff. This morning I had a feature this week. So this is what I wrote down.
Oh, God.
They had a feature this week on the man with Britain's biggest penis. That was on, I think it was Tuesday.
This is cutting edge journalism.
Yeah.
James, imagine I call Boydo at that point, right, to discuss something with him, and he go, and I was like, "What are you watching now?" He's the man with the biggest penis. And I was
biggest
like,
penis in Britain. Yeah.
I mean
this is what I'm having to deal with.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but how do they know?
Well, it's a good question.
It sounds like a challenge.
Giving it the bigger. No,
objection, Your Honour.
Literally, James is. Yeah. What are you saying? Well, the people who have claimed they've got a big penis and have told and
isn't
have
that
revealed
every man?
What their measurements are. And this guy is the top of that list.
What? I mean, I can't believe I'm being drawn into this conversation. What size are we talking?
Do you know what? I can't remember how many.
I feel like this was pertinent information.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're talking like, I don't know, like 10, 11, something like that. And
inches,
it's girth
rather
as well.
Centimeters.
And, yeah.
Oh my God. So, what state was said member in during the measuring? I suppose that's an important one.
I thought you meant on this morning.
Wait, you actually saw the penis?
No. They just showed
a silhouette.
No. So they properly buried the lead on
this. He was live in the studio. He didn't get it out, but he was live in the
Pixar
studio.
Pixar, it didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what was very funny was, is that he's actually talking about how much of it's a curse. Right?
Oh,
yeah, as you can imagine, James.
Well, presumably trips up quite a lot.
James doesn't have to imagine. But what was funny, genuinely...
Was it Liam Neeson?
It was not Liam Neeson, no. Rumours,
oh
who
God,
knows
no,
if those rumours are true.
Sick.
But on ITV's daytime offering, like from Lorraine, Lorraine always, they'd always plug it. So Lorraine went to Ben Shepherd and, what's her name?
Kat Dealey,
who are the hosts of this one, as you know, James. And she's got, what have you got on the show? Just saying, like, well, we've got the man with Britain's
a giant
biggest,
cock.
The man with Britain's biggest penis, and you can imagine, all hell broke loose. It was very funny. So it was worth seeing if anyone on ITV Play can be bothered. The handover, I thought it was hilarious.
So to speak,
yeah, the handover.
I often watch
Lorraine as well. And of course, Lucy Cave, our former boss at Bowers, she's on it all the time. Lucy Cave's on, she's like, you know.
We're still talking about the TV show, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Lorraine, yeah, not... Yes. Good. Anyway, so that's what I've been watching. And the final thing in my actual things that I made a note of while I was watching them, because I thought it was funny, is programs featuring Michael Portillo talking of big penises.
Oh my God, I really do feel sick. I've been laughing. I mean,
yeah, talking it, because he is obviously like an MP who I personally, does not fit with my personal politics particularly, right? Michael Portillo. But he has become, right, the leading exponent of travel shows involving trains.
Yeah, he's
right?
The train man.
Mm-hmm. He is the train man. He's made an extraordinary career of himself. And he's currently on two channels at the moment. He's on BBC Two, Monday to Friday, Great Coastal Railway Journeys. And he's on Channel 5 on Friday, Michael Portillo's Long Weekends. It's difficult to avoid him. But I have to say, he's really good at it. I'm going to give him credit for it. So even though politically, couldn't be more different from me. He's good. And no comments on
his undercarriage.
Absolutely not, no. But I refer to him as a big penis. No, in a
joke.
As a joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so lots of Michael Till shows. That's what we've been watching.
I don't know where to go with this segment now.
I feel like we peaked, so to speak.
Mm. What have you been watching, James?
Well, I finished Mr. and Mrs. Smith, finally.
Oh, it's good, isn't it?
Which I enjoyed, although it does have a cliffhangery ending, which irked me slightly.
How did it end again? I can't remember.
I can't say that. It'd be a spoiler.
I've watched it.
Yeah, I know you have. But crucially, Kate, we're doing a podcast with an audience, and not all of them will have seen it.
Oh, my God. I'd said that on the Ask Me Anything. I was like, I actually do forget. I just think it's us sticking around in a room.
Yeah. I mean, after Boyd's penis chat, it may well be. Well. But, So I finished Mr. and Mrs. Smith, very much enjoyed that. And then Because I feel like I was out of step with most people, I decided to give Fallout another go. So I watched the rest of Fallout. So I've got all the way to the end of Fallout. I've now watched all of Fallout. And I enjoyed it more in the second half than I did the first half. I think I started to get more... I warmed to the characters slightly more. I thought the humour kind of settled quite nicely in sort of the latter episodes. I still don't think it's fabulous. Like, all these people saying, it's amazing, it's better than The Last of Us. Is it? Fuck. But it was quite fun. I enjoyed it.
It's got a lot of really good reviews.
It has,
I was surprised how good... Yeah.
I don't like it as much as most people do, but I enjoyed it enough to press on to the end, and I had a good old time watching the rest of it. I did not, resent the time I spent watching the rest of it, so.
Well, you'll be excited by some news coming up then.
Will I now?
Mm-hmm. But that's it's a little tease. Section, yeah, it's a little tease.
Okay. What could it possibly be? It's a mystery.
Well, he doesn't know. Look, he's
I don't.
He's
I don't know what this
face.
Is.
Yeah.
No
anyway,
idea.
Sorry, carry
not
on.
A clue.
No.
Not a sausage. So to speak. Right, anyway, that's
what... Let's do this sausage with you.
Oh, God. That's what we've been watching. Let's very, very hastily whiz on to a listener question. Kay, what do you have for us this week?
So this question comes from Tom Meller, who says, in the next series of Reacher, if the book is followed, there'll be a character called Paulie who is significantly bigger than Reacher. Given Alan Ritchson is an absolute monster, who can possibly be cast to play Paulie?
Godzilla.
Sorry.
You can't see it, but he's like, he's making his eyes go all weird. Yeah. Googly. From side to side.
I'm just going to Google tallest actor.
I'm going to say, no, I'm going to go for listener of the pod, great friend of mine, Idris Elba.
Big Chris.
Because he's a big guy, and also, oh, actually, at that juncture, I should say, Boydo, give me a pound.
Why?
Because we said last week, Idris, because, you said he was listening.
Yeah.
And if he gets in touch, then I owe you a pound. But so far, a week has passed and Idris has not made contact with us.
Yeah, that's not... I don't know whether there was a time limit on the...
so we'll just go on for the rest of the time.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Seems like a good bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, of course, Stephen Merchant is like 6'7".
But he's not necessarily
He's
hench.
Not necessarily hench. But he's a big guy. It'd be difficult. How tall is Reacher officially?
Reacher is supposed to be 6'4".
Yeah, you see, so, Merchant would have 3 inches on him, so to speak. This is not back to...
I believe Alan Richman might be 6'3".
Okay.
Oh, Big Tom Davis then will be...
Big Tom Davis?
Yeah.
Possibly.
That's a good shout.
Yeah, he's very, very big.
He'll be, unfortunately, detained because he'll be fighting Ricky Gervais in the ring at that particular point, so...
Oh, that's true. Brad Garrett from Everyone Loves Raymond, apparently 6'8", so he's got another inch over him. But yeah, all these people are probably...
We're very length-obsessed, this podcast.
Oh, we are.
A lot of measuring going on.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Yeah.
Who would you say?
Who would I say, other than Godzilla? I don't know, but I don't think one necessarily needs to find someone taller than Alan Ritchson to play Paulie. You just need another great big... beefsteak of a man who looks like he needs to be someone who is Arnie's probably a bit old for it, but you need someone who is a credible physical threat, which is difficult because Alan Ritchson has at this point reached almost absurd proportions. Like, he's so hench, it's almost like
how does he stand upright?
Well,
how does he get close to fit him?
I feel a lot like if he were to ever fall down, he would not be able to get up unassisted.
Jason Momoa. There we go. Someone
that's
like
a good shout, boy.
Someone
though,
like him.
Yeah.
He could do it.
I do remember the picture of Jason Momoa with his bodyguards on the set of one of the films, and like he was a clear head and shoulders taller than any of them. And it was just like, I think the caption someone said, it's like these are all like the little mini bosses you have to fight before you get to the main boss.
He's 6'4" and he's got the heft.
Yes.
He really has, yeah.
He's a big lad.
Yeah. So I think he's the answer to the question.
Perfect.
So just to be clear, that was the listener question this week. Who should play Paulie?
That's the one I've chosen at
right,
random.
That's the one.
And it seems fitting as well.
The one that you've carefully selected in advance.
Yes,
that
exactly.
One. Okay, great.
Yes.
Okay, good, good.
Knowing
good.
That Boyd would bring up what he did earlier in the conversation, I thought it was important to talk about
height. It was good that we were able to dispose of that quickly because Boydie, as we have discussed, has a hard out because he has to go and watch Doctor Who. So let us press on then from said listener question to this week's interview. And we've got a couple of guests this week. Obviously, as you probably know, The Responder made our Shows of the Year list when it first aired in 2022. It's back on the BBC One this week with Martin Freeman as Merseyside Police Officer Chris Carson, a, I think it's fairly safe to say, problematic law enforcement personality who is now determined to find his way onto the day shift. So the Breeders' star turned responder, Martin Freeman, stopped by to chat with Boyd alongside the show's creator and former Liverpudlian copper, Tony Schumacher.
I think it's about 2.5 years ago since we gathered at that hotel where you are to launch the show, Series 1.
Yeah, because it started in late January 2022.
Then. Don't know. I think, because COVID had just finished.
So it would have been at the end, it would have been like at the end of 2021, I suppose.
That's right,
So come on, why has it taken so long, Tony, to come to the screen? Did you have to pull your finger out and just write the Series 2? And how much of a challenge was that?
I think basically boils down to I'm just a terrible writer.
finally, someone's admitted it.
You've said it enough times. it was just looking. I mean, it was scheduled as well, like obviously came into play. But it just felt that let's not rush this thing, you know. Let's just take our time with it. Because we had something special our first time, and it would have been a shame to squander that thing that we had, you know, by just turning out a rubbish sequel. You know, we didn't want to do that. So, I'm sorry, mate.
No, it's fine. It's worth the wait. Definitely worth the wait.
It's so funny because by my side, it just doesn't feel long at all. Because I think I've, in my life, I've tended to not...
You've done so much in between, haven't you?
I think. I suppose so.
Yeah, this is like the second longest job I've ever had, I think.
It's
a car crash.
But no, for me, it feels like you did get a wiggle on, you know.
I think once we got the themes and once we got the thing that felt right, the actual writing of it came quite quickly. I think once it came down to actually sitting down and banging it out, you know, came quickly. But I think we just took our time. It was me and Toby Bruce, one of the producers, and Jess Moons. We just sat and talked and mulled and maybe went up and down a few blind alleys. And then eventually, I think we all just went, and you were involved in that process as well. We just sort of went, hang on, like, whoa, that's it. That's it. Let's go with this, you know. Mm-hmm. So when it was right, it felt right, you know.
How involved are you in that process, Martin? Like, did you after Series 1 finishes, do you then have a chat with Tony about how Series 2 is going to go and what trajectory it's going to have?
Yes, but I wouldn't make any claims of, I wouldn't try and overstate that. I'm sort of there, I'm there or thereabouts, but I'm, you know, I make the odd appearance in the writer's room, but no, it's mainly you, Toby, and Jess. And it's like,
I think you're there in a way, which is, because obviously we talk a lot, but you're there in a way that you're always there, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You're always there because it's, we're trying to, this sounds terrible, this is a really bad way to put it, but in a way, I'm trying to please you because I know you will only do something that's good.
Right.
So, like, you're always there in that respect that I'm thinking, there's no way for him to do that, you know. So, like, let's work on this. Let's go there. Let's try that. That aspect of it.
No, that's a nice thing. I think, you know, and me and Tony do, you know, we are in contact with each other. We do stay in touch with each other about all sorts of stuff and obviously not least this show. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got the measure of each other's taste and what we're sort of after in doing this show. Because, you know, in doing this show again, it wasn't obvious to me that we should do the show again. No, do you know what I mean? It wasn't obvious.
Well, that was a conversation that we had even when we were doing Season 1.
Yeah.
It was like, what are we going to do next? It was never like a thing that we, like, let's do this next. It was never as cut and dried, you know, that this was definitely going to be a thing.
Yeah, I was very happy with it being a one-er.
I was just going to go back and work at the tip.
Were you overly happy for it to be a one-er, Martin, because it's such an intense role?
Not for that reason, because I love the intensity of the role, you know. I mean, it's not my whole life playing that level of intensity, maybe not. I like some relief as well, but you know, every actor, I think some people are lazy, I guess, but most actors want to play intense stuff, you know, because you're painfully engaged for that 12 hours that you're in that day. You've really worked hard. You've laughed, you've cried, you've fought someone, you've shouted, you've stared at a wall, all that stuff, you know. So it wasn't that. It was more, I've always been suspicious of the factory element of it, I guess, because I don't just want to keep feeding the beast, you know, just because you can, you know. And I think that was lessons learned, you know, as a child from Fawlty Towers and as a young actor, Ricky and Stephen with The Office, is like, no, we're done. We've done it. Mm. And I've always really admired that. I've always really admired just people going, no, we've done what we want to do, said what we want to say, and now we're off, you know. And rather than here's another series. Mm. So that the amount of times people go, oh, please do another one of these, please do another one of these. And you know it would be only a matter of time before they went, why are they still doing this shit?
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
it turns yeah. very quickly, you know, sickle that thing. So no, not because of the intensity of it. I love playing Chris. I really love playing Chris. And I feel it's one of, even though, of course, on the face of it, he's nothing like me, I feel I'm able to access him as better than most things I've done, and as at least as well as any other role I've played. I relate to him a lot. And as I say, on the face of it, we don't have an awful lot in common. But I love playing him. But that's almost, you know, and I think we've done a good job with, you know, with series one. I think we've done a thing that I'm really proud of.
Mm.
I just don't want to keep doing that thing to keep pushing it. Do you know
what I mean? I literally can't hold down a job for 5 minutes, you know. And the idea of clocking on, you know, every week to do another episode of Responder, another series of Responder, is, God, it just sounds like hell to me. You know, there's so many other things that you want to explore, you know, and you want to try and figure out. So I think we both thought like that, you know.
Mm. There's so much going on in each episode. I was watching the first couple of the new series. Like, you feel like it must take a long time to reach that level of intensity in the storytelling. Like episode two, that, you know, how it all builds up with all the different elements. You've got the guy in the car with you, you know, the two, all the different characters coming together for this bit. Like, does that, I don't know, this was your first, the series one was your first TV script, right? Does that kind of storytelling come naturally to you, Tony?
I don't know any other way of doing it, you know. In season two, you look at all, we've had these characters, you know, who we've got to know, or I've got to know, and who I've lived with for such a long time, that it would just be madness to me to say, I don't want more Rachel, I don't want more Adelaide, you know, I don't want more Marco, I don't want more Emily. You just want to squeeze as much into it as you possibly can, in my opinion. And it makes it more difficult, because obviously if I'm just staying with Chris, it's kind of, I can have loads of long, moody moments where, great, that's 30 seconds. You know, I'll save you right now for Paige. But the reality is I want to know what's happening to these people, and I want to experience that thing with them. So it's, I'll always squeeze it as much as possible. You know, I just love it. I just love all that.
They do feel very packed, the episodes. I mean, like, you know, we pack a lot into 58 minutes or whatever.
Right.
I do enjoy that.
I do miss, we you know, there are moments where, one of the great things that I enjoyed about when I was a cop was the moments of silence, you know. And sometimes I do think, oh God, you know, she'll have to have a page there for that, you know. But I think what you do so well is Martin captures those moments in shorthand almost, you know. You'll get those moments in very brief, whereas I'd be like these terrible moments of him looking over the cliffs with raging seas. You do that in a way which is so easily done for you. It's so not easily, but quickly done, you know.
Right.
You speed that up.
Those shots of you of Chris in the car, you know, in the kind of with the neon kind of light, it feels very Taxi Driver. It struck me. I don't know if I've noticed that before.
No, I'm sure at some point that was a visual for our directors and DOPs. Yeah, it's lonely. It's sort of lonely, but also that's where Chris thrives, isn't it? He does want to be alone. He's he likes acting alone until he then has to act as a tour with Rachel. And actually he can tolerate Rachel. He can bear, she's one of the few people he can tolerate.
Mm.
Vice versa. They do find each other bearable.
Yeah, they're both complex, you know.
Yeah.
But luckily enough, they're like gears, you know, the incredibly difficult to mesh together, but they found someone that they mesh with, you know, and they fit in together. Yeah, maybe not helpful, but that's who they are.
Yes.
A lot of people kind of assumed, because you said you were very open about the fact, Tony, that you took experiences from your own life, and obviously you did this job, but people would say, oh, you know, is Martin playing a version of you? But you're so different. I mean, you're such an affable guy, right?
You wait till the laptop shows, boy. I'm just an absolute...
I mean, I just think Chris is like, whatever you say about Chris, affable isn't the word I'd necessarily use.
No, it's not. I'm not...
Were you like that in the job, though? That's my question.
You know what? I've still got mates who know me, you know, mates who work with me, and I've still, you know, but I feel a different person now than the person I was when I was doing that job. I think I'm probably more, what's the word? I'm mellowed, I think. I think I'm a lot mellower than what I was when I was doing the job. But at the same time, Chris is very much an exaggerated version of what I was like, you know. Chris is a kind of an amalgam of about five or six people who I know throughout life, not just as cops, can be difficult. And I think, but I was, you know, I'm just nice, Boyd.
That's the point. He's quite a nice bloke.
I wasn't always, let's just say.
Yeah. Have you got more affable as you've got older, Martin, or are you all?
Maybe I might have. I don't think I've changed massively. I've changed in some ways, but
I think it'd be weird if you didn't, though, wouldn't it? I think if you went through life and you were the same person you were when you were 21, like
Different energy.
Yeah, and experiences affect you, and you know.
Yeah, you get your ass kicked.
Yeah,
by
exactly.
Life.
Exactly.
It's going to slow you down a minute. Yeah, it's true. But yeah, I mean. But that's why, you are not, ostensibly, you're not like Chris, and I'm not like Chris, but I think we both like living there. I think you and me both like occupying that space artistically.
Yeah, I also think, though, you and me both have, you know, we are not like Chris, but I think there's elements of Chris. I think there's part of you and there's part of me in it. I do believe that it's somewhere in between us.
No, probably.
He's a bit of Chris.
But I think, we're not that person. And also we're probably quite good at, you know, the showbiz side of us is a bit more up and, you know, whereas Chris doesn't have that outlet.
No.
And people like Chris, then he's not in showbiz. So all he is his car and meeting, you know, a lot of challenging experiences in the course of a night. So I don't mean, he's easily where I could be. But the thing that attracted me to playing Chris was probably the stuff, you know, that Tony can access, that I can also access, which is that darker side of stuff. And that's not trying to make us sound like interesting poets. But I think we are probably both in our work drawn to that. Mm-hmm. And it's the thing that in your real life can be a massive pain in the ass for people around you. And I know it sometimes is for me, absolutely. I'm not always the easiest person. But in my work, that's where I like exploring. I totally like exploring that. It's interesting to me. I'm fascinated by it, you know, by what makes us tick, you know.
Do you have to, it's such a physically, like as soon as he arrives back on screen, he's got that, it's almost like shaking. He's like, do you have to psych yourself up to get into the zone to play him, or is it just, were you back in kind of pretty much straight away?
It happens sort of as you go, really. So it's sort of, I mean, you prepare and you focus the mind and the body before you get onto set, I guess. But it happens as soon as you put the uniform on. For me, it happens as soon as I'm in the accent. You move differently, you express yourself differently. And even when he's not in the uniform, he holds himself in a different way, you know.
I was calling it the waste of the warrant card. It's such a melodramatic way of putting it. But like when I left the police, for literally for years afterwards, I'd always tap me back pocket looking for my warrant card. And it wasn't there. And it does affect you losing that thing, but it also affects you carrying that thing. I think that's, to me, is what Chris and what you bring to that is the weight of that warrant card.
It's always there.
It's like a conscience that you're always carrying around. You know?
I always bang on about reading Tony's sort of pilot script for this 5 years ago. And one of the things that really attracted to me about it was he was relatively a man of relatively few words, right? And I felt I got him immediately. So the way part partly because I understand that, but also because Tony had painted the picture well, that you don't need to over-explain this person. Like, you know how he moves in the world. You know, and I'm not a copper. I don't claim to know much about that job at all. But you understand him on a sort of primate level. And you understood him very, very, like, immediately on episode, you know. It's really good to play. It's a really good part to play, just selfishly. I like playing those kind of emotions and those kind of moods, and, you know, having that color in your palette is, it is really why you become an actor. Yeah.
It must be so juicy because it's got so, even more now in series two, I feel, in series one, he's got so many moral dilemmas and so many.
Also, Tony's had the smart idea of bringing his dad into it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's a whole other theme to it. Yeah. And I didn't know he was going to do that. But when he did it, I was like, oh, yeah, of course, that's what we need.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought of that before.
Played by Bernard Hill, who is obviously a legend. Tony, did you have him in mind for that role, or how did that happen?
You know what? I didn't have him in mind for that role, but he's the reason why I'm a writer. There's no getting away from it. Him and Alan Blaisdell are the reason why probably 99% of writers in Liverpool are writers, you know? And it was the minute that we started talking about casting that role, the minute that his name walked into the room, it was like a face of complaint amongst all of us, you know? And we had that with so many of the actors in this... show, though, that there's so many people who, the minute you saw them, you went, bang, that's who we want, you know. But the second we started talking about Bernard, you know, he's got a, when I say he's got a gravity, there is, like, he bends space, you know, when he sits in that chair, like, you know, he's sitting in that chair, you know. He's an impressive guy.
He is, yeah. And I buy him as my dad.
Oh, my God. And, you know, the honour of bringing Bernard Hill back to Liverpool, you know, it's not Jose. It's a completely different character from Jose. But the joy of bringing Bernard back to Liverpool.
Fantastic.
TV, you know what I mean? I'll settle for that.
It completely works. Yeah, it's fantastic. And just, I want to mention Kevin Eldon in that kind of cameo. So, I mean, another great bit of casting. He's so fantastic as this kind of...
He's really good, isn't he?
I'm
glad for him that he's doing more straight stuff. I mean, you know, because we all know how funny he is and how funny he has always been, but it's nice that he's doing more of that stuff that stretches a different muscle.
You don't want to stretch a comic, you know, because it's such a cliche. Like, but his was another name that the second that we started talking about casting that role, it was like, it's Kevin Eldon, you know, let's go with that.
Yeah.
You know, that confused, just childlike quality.
He does that really well. And you do feel a lot for that character. He's completely lost. Yeah. He's really at sea. He has a lovely vulnerability to him. But also, you know, what's another thing that's nice about Tony's writing is he offsets that with the farce of Casey suddenly joining in that, and then Marco joining it. So then we got Scooby-Doo van, you know, with me and Rachel, you know, like, and three nutters in the back seat, you know.
Yeah. It really is a farcical. I thought it was so funny. Yeah, that mix, the darkness and the light and the kind of comedy of it is fantastically woven in at that point. Yeah, it's...
I think that's what you always said, you know, like when we were first talking, the stuff that could be on the surface of it, you know, stories, you know, sort of war stories from the police that make most people go, cool, that's a bit much. But there's always a lightness to it, you know, in your... There's always something that's funny as a coder.
You know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. It was the one thing you were guaranteed to have a laugh. You know, even in the darkest of moments, you know, it might be with a victim of crime, or it might be with a witness, or it might be with a criminal or a colleague, you'd have a laugh, and you'd be remiss to not remember that, you know, in the right.
You do also kind of almost by stealth, I think, say a lot about what's going on in the world right now in this country. You know, there's people with mental health issues, how there's no help for them at all. You know, Kevin Eldon's character feels like a kind of summary of that in a way. And I thought the way you dealt with domestic abuse in series one, and that's echoing now through series two as well, was so powerful as well. Are these things that you like? Does it come naturally to you, weave those big things into the story, into what is a very entertaining show, or do you have to work at that?
I think it's just natural, really, because I'm like essentially angry about that stuff all the time. But like, I don't want a soapbox show, you know, because there's people who do polemic a lot better than me. And there's nothing worse than having a writer like, it's episode five. There's Martin's speech for five pages of Martin staring out at the sea and screaming about the
cats.
But yeah, you know, I mean, no one else is doing that. So fucking do it. And get. And also, you know, I think the audience don't necessarily want to see five episodes of that, you know. So if I know, I don't. So it's nice for me to do it in a way which maybe you don't realise it's happened, but if it sinks in, that's great.
It's as you said, Boyd, I think it's by stealth.
Yeah.
And I think it's, there's an argument to be said that everything is better by stealth.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's taking medicine or, you know, learning a lesson at school or, you know, whatever, rather than going, we're now going to teach you something about the state of the nation and mental illness and, you know, the crisis of masculinity or whatever. It's like, well, that always just feels icky to me. That feels icky. But if you tell human stories, but you're also getting in some of this stuff under the radar and without me even noticing it.
Yeah.
Because all I'm interested in is doing interesting dramatic stories. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And interaction between interesting characters. That's what I'm interested in. And guess what? When that happens, you will be learning other stuff, you know. But if you're leading with that, it always feels too worthy and too, you know, tin pot politico stuff, and I'm not really into that.
Is it easier filming now this time around in Liverpool at night and all of that? Do they kind of know who you are?
It was easy because it's like just later on in the COVID thing, you know, because at the time we were filming in 2021, and so it was still a bit COVID-y, and it was less busy than I assumed it would be, because I thought Liverpool 1 o'clock in the morning, which is going to be a bit tasty, and it was always fine. It was always fine. And it was fine this time as well, but it felt more like a functioning city now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When we were there before,
yeah,
it was definitely not functioning at itself.
The way moments like, you know, when we look at dailies, you know, and you just see there'd be just nothing happening other than what we were seeing on the screen. And we'd always have to be very careful about making it not look like a theatre set, you know, with a backdrop.
Yeah.
Whereas this time, it does feel more alive.
Yeah.
And I think the beauty of Liverpool to film in is Liverpool's very used to being filmed in now. There's so much getting made there that I think people can pass in the background and not.
You know,
we don't get many people stopping to watch filming. People just get on with their life, you know, and just make it. You know, the film office are great in that regard. But I think it's given it a slightly different vibe, the show as well. It felt a little bit more alive for me watching it, you know.
People loved it as well. I mean, I'm sure not everyone in Liverpool does, and I don't know.
I know everyone in Liverpool.
but I've heard so many positive,
it's been a
really, really positive reactions from the city, from every, you know, from whether it's official people or just people in the street. They all seemed happy to have us.
I walked, my office was in the centre of the city. This is a true story. So I walked out of my office the other week to go and get something from Greg's or something. And as I walked out the office, there was a tour bus going past, and I literally heard, and on our left-hand side, there's Tony Schumacher. There's Tony Schumacher. He don't respond there. And I looked at all these people on the tour bus looking at me and stuff.
Funny.
And it was so weird.
Matt Freeman in this morning.
And it turned out it was the guy who'd written the music from the first episode. We played a single from a band who'd then disbanded. Oh. They've now reconvened. For the life of me, I can't think of the name of the band. But he's the tour guide on the bus. Yeah, and he just seen me go, I've never met the guy, but he recognised me. I can't think of the name of the band. Brilliant band. And I got talking to him afterwards because he dropped me a message and went, I'm sorry about that. But I got talking to him afterwards and he said the number of people who say on that bus about Liverpool, talk about Liverpool, talk about watching the show the first time, the number of people who mention him, the show, everything else, the number of people who I meet just at the match or just on the street who talk about it, it's been phenomenal. Incredible.
How are you feeling finally, Tony, about Everton? Another 2 points deducted.
Do you know what, mate? This was going so well, boy.
I'm sorry.
Oh, mate, I was talking to you, Phil, about this the other week. It's just so depressing. It's almost like I just want, you know, my mate's dog at the moment is coming to the end of its life and it keeps falling over every time it has a poo in the garden. And everyone keeps saying, mate, just take it to vets and get it put down. That's how I feel about it. come on, let's just go to Vets and get it put down. Let's just get it over with.
Yeah.
Honestly. We keep falling in our own shit.
Yeah.
on that note, charming. But yeah, I get it. Yeah. Thank you so much. Congratulations on a brilliant start to Series 2 as well. Thank you. Cheers, Martin.
Thanks so much, please. Thank you.
That was Martin Freeman and Tony Schumacher, and it's time now for news. Kay, do you want to regale us with the news that you teased so tantalisingly earlier on?
The news that I thought James would particularly be excited about is that Fallout has been renewed for a second season on Amazon Prime Video.
That's yeah, I'm interested to see where it goes, actually. I would like to see more of this. I got sufficiently, shall we say, intrigued by the ongoing story arc that I want to know where it goes.
Well, good news all around there.
Yeah.
Also, some Paramount Plus news. They've announced further casting for the original drama Curfew. That's the working title. So Lucy Benjamin, Larry Lamb, Bobby Brazier and Anita Dobson will be joining the cast. So it's a bit of an EastEnders reunion.
A bit? It's like you're only allowed to be in this cast if you've been in EastEnders. It's weird. Well, I found that really odd.
There's nothing wrong with that.
James doesn't know who we're talking about. But all four cast members in this show, James, used to be in EastEnders. That's not right. That's weird, isn't it?
I mean, but surely if you go back down most British actors' CVs, you'll find out the square on there somewhere.
These were big part. These were not just, you know, like happened to be in an episode of The Bill. These were ongoing, famous EastEnders characters.
Yeah, all good
and
actors.
Now they've all been cast in another show. Apparently, it's just, I think it's bizarre. Anyway, carry on.
Anyway, it's an adaptation of Jane Cowie's novel After Dark. And
WestEnders.
And I'll read the press release. It says, in a society governed by the Women's Safety Act, where men are tracked by an ankle tag
and forced to watch EastEnders
and confined to their homes watching EastEnders by a strict curfew from 7 p.m. every night, a woman's body is discovered brutally murdered in curfew hours. So intriguing.
Colour me intrigued. They've announced some guest stars in the new series of Heartstopper. Do you see this? Quite interesting. It's kind of gone, you could say it's gone up a notch. Johnny Bailey, who we interviewed very podcast, Kay's favourite.
Soon to be seen in Bridgerton again.
Yeah, back in Bridgerton soon. He's in it. Hayley Atwell, absolutely brilliant star of Mission Impossible. Which one was it, James?
The most recent one.
Yeah.
Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Thank you. Hayley Atwell and Eddie Marsan. The great Eddie Marsan. They're all going to be in Heartstopper Season 3. Atwell will play Diane, Nick's aunt, who takes him on a summer holiday to Menorca. Marsan will play Jeff, Charlie's wise and straight-talking therapist, who first appeared in the Heartstopper graphic novels. And Johnny Bailey will make a cameo appearance as Jack Maddox, an Instagram-famous classicist and celebrity crush of Charlie's.
I can see that.
Yeah, there you go. So three.
How exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Because Olivia, I think they announced recently Olivia Colman wouldn't be in this series because she's obviously quite busy. But I think those stars would add hugely to the next third season.
Absolutely.
Mm.
The trailer was released for the fourth season of Trying. I don't know if anyone saw that. So that's going to be back on the 22nd of May on Apple TV Plus.
And we will have interviewed the two stars, Rafe Spall and Esther Smith, as well.
Indeed.
In fact, yeah.
An interview that took place this very day.
Exactly. Did you see that Steve Carell and Tina Fey are doing a Netflix show called Four Seasons?
But is it a film?
No, it's a series.
Oh.
Yeah. Steve Carell is set to star opposite Tina Fey in the upcoming Netflix comedy series, The Four Seasons. The series is based on the 1981, this is the interesting bit, it's based on the 1981 film of the same name that was directed by and starring Alan Alda, with Carol Burnett, Rita Moreno, Sandy Dennis, and Lynn Cariou. That is one of my favourite films, The Four Seasons.
I feel like you say that a lot.
Well, I've got a lot of favourite films, yeah.
Okay, fine.
But it is. And I went to see that when it came out in the cinema. My parents took me to see that, me and my brother. And I would have been 67, 77, 14 years old. And I absolutely loved it. It uses the Vivaldi Four Seasons piece of music in all the way through. And it traces these different interrelationships across the four seasons in a year. But I loved Alan Alda when I was growing up in MASH. Obviously, he was famous in MASH. And he made a few films himself. And this is, I think, the best one. I absolutely loved it. I haven't seen it for years. So I've now been spurred on to go and see it. And I wonder if it's dated terribly. It's going to be shit. But I hope not. So yeah, the Four Seasons coming up with Steve Carell and Tina Fey.
Speaking of Steve Carell, there is a spin-off of The Office US coming. And they announced two cast members, didn't they, Boydie?
I don't know. I haven't heard this story.
They have, Boydie. They have announced a spin-off The Office, and it has cast someone very near and dear to this podcast in a central role.
Oh.
Do you know who it is?
No.
Don Gleason.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely Donal. True. Yes.
Wow. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting, yeah.
Donal, congratulations, Arsenal. Listening as you are to this podcast.
World-famous Aston Villa fan, Donal Gleason.
Yeah.
Who sat next to me at the Arsenal-Aston Villa game where they beat us 2-0 and possibly ruined our season, we'll see.
Not that he's bitter.
That's exciting. Very good.
Yes, that was true. Severance Season 2 has finished filming.
That's taken a long time.
It has taken a long time, but they have done. They are done with season two, so I don't know when we're going to get it, but at least it is shot. Mm. And speaking of Apple things, Neuromancer, another one of Apple's thoughtful elite sci-fi shows, has added Callum Turner from Masters of the Air to its cast list.
Oh.
So good news there too.
Hunky Callum Turner.
Hunky Callum Turner.
And there's a Becoming Karl Lagerfeld series on Disney Plus.
I did see an advert for it.
Yeah. And I thought of James immediately.
Because they did the Balenciaga run, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's like the second, it's quite weird, isn't it? Disney Plus going for another series about a real life fashion designer. It's a real like new genre almost. We've had loads of them mm-hmm. recently. This stars Daniel Brühl, who's always very good as the iconic fashion designer. They've unveiled the trailer. It looks quite fun, actually, I thought, from the trailer. It's going to arrive in the US on June 7th and quite soon after, I think, on Disney Plus. And it has got lots of famous people in it as well, like these other fashion designer dramas have as well.
What's the third one? What was the other
New
one
look.
You did? Yeah, but who was it? So it was one about Balenciaga. What's the other one?
Christian Dior.
Christian Dior.
The famous people that are going to be depicted in this show include Marlena Dietrich, who we played by Sunny Melles from Triangle of Sadness. I don't know how to pronounce her name, sorry. Paloma Picasso will be in it, played by Jean Damas. And Andy Warhol will pop up, played by Paul Sperrer, etc. So that's kind of, you know, it can be quite interesting. But no,
I've got fatigue. I've got fashion designer fatigue at the moment.
Fair enough. Well, ignore it then. Except we'll probably end up reviewing it on this very podcast, because that, Kay, is what we do.
This is the life we chose, the life we lead.
Exactly.
There is but one guarantee. None of us will see a decent show. Right, let's wrap up news there, shall we? Excellent. Let's move on then to this week's reviews. And we begin with the aforementioned massively subtitled show Spy Master, or Spy / Master, to give it its proper punctuation. And this is on BBC4. It's a Cold War thriller about a Romanian intelligence officer and kind of the right-hand man to the Romanian dictator. And he's not only a mole for the KGB, but he's also looking to defect to the United States. He's been a very busy little bee. Kay, please tell us, was this a show that you would defect for?
Yes, I would. I found this really gripping. As you say, yeah, he's spy. He's the right-hand man of the Romanian president, yet he's spying for the Russians and also is set to defect. And this follows him across 1 week, which I quite enjoy, right? So there's not too many time-hopping we've seen recently.
So this is an interesting question here, because I wasn't sure if there was time hopping going on or not. Like, I got quite confuzzled at various points in this.
There was definitely time hopping, but it's not very signposted, is it?
No. So you're just like, is this? Did this take place before? I'm very confused. Are we still in Germany? Where are we now? I was very.
Yeah, no, they expect you to get a grip on the fact that they're flashbacking.
They did not.
Flashbacking.
Yes, I got a little bit confused with the bit when the American embassy, and I thought, but. It wasn't as... Basically, my benchmark for it now is Feud, with the ridiculous amount of time hopping, right? The five different time hops in the space of like 20 minutes. So
right.
That was what we did last week, and so I was quite relieved when it wasn't as time hoppy. But yeah, I just found it completely fascinating and tense and incredibly compelling, just because I love to see all the spy ways. And I just found him a really fascinating character, played by Alex Sicariani. So overall, I really, really did enjoy this. And the fact that it's based on real life as well always makes it...
He's a fictional character, though.
He is a fictional character. Yeah. Sorry, yes, but he is based on a gentleman whose name I'm not even going to try and attempt to say.
And Nicolae Ceaușescu was the actual leader of Romania at that time, who became his confidant.
What do you think, Boydo?
Well, I liked it as well. I did get annoyed by the time jumping. Mm-hmm. It does time jump, and I just thought it was unnecessary, particularly in this case where... So the setup is that he has been caught or about to be caught because he's a double agent.
Yep.
He's partly working for Moscow, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, he's still Ceaușescu's... you know, like right hand man or whatever. And then the then he goes to get, you know, to what's the word when you go to America when you're, when you're a spy?
Defect.
Defect. Oh, thank defect. You. He goes to defect to America with the help of American Secret Service people. And you see that early on, and then it flashes back, without telling you it's flashing back, to what happened earlier that week, as you say.
But it does say that. It says, say, 10 days earlier or something. Or 4 days early. It flashed up.
Oh, did it? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Fine.
I missed that as well.
I missed that as well, yeah.
Are you sure you didn't imagine that?
Interesting.
No, it definitely
did. Or did you get one with different subtitles to the rest of us?
I'm, both of us didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I wonder if that's...
But then Boydie might have been watching The Chase at the same time.
That's true.
And I could have... I could have been like doing something else. I don't know,
the
ceiling or something.
They said, because I remember thinking, oh, okay, so this we're seeing what leads up to.
I mean, I got that, even without that, I got that it was flashing back, but I just didn't... I didn't quite see the point of that. I thought it was, it would be gripping enough in chronological order. But then
but
I
you
do
can say
think
that about anything, right?
Well, yeah, and I do and have to.
It is in fact a big Boydie bugbear.
It still is my bugbear, and I still maintain that probably more than half the time this happens, and it is a very fashionable thing now, particularly. I think we've reached peak TV, we've reached peak messing around in time TV, and that it's just a bit of a lazy way of telling stories. But it didn't put me off entirely, because I do think it was really gripping, and he is fantastic. He was brilliant in God's Own Country, the Alex Sicariano,
yeah.
And he's great in this, because he's constantly on edge. And you know what it reminded me of, which kind of, totally coincidentally, I watched on TV last week, BBC One showed Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the Gary Oldman version, the film, which is, do you know what it is, Kay? It's one of my favourite films. And
two in one show.
Fucking brilliant, that film. And that is an object lesson in how to adapt a spy story, how to tell a spy story. And there are flashbacks in that, but they've sewn in so brilliantly. And obviously adapted from John le Carré. This has got a very strong John le Carré vibe and a Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy vibe. Visually, it feels very similar because it's a similar period. The cars and the kind of architecture and all of that is very similar to what you'll see in the film of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And even the pace of it and the kind of the everything about, I think I have no idea. I haven't read any interviews, any of the creators or anything like that, but it just feels like heavily influenced by that film in particular. And why wouldn't it be? Because that is an object lesson in how to do this kind of story. And it does. And the reason I think people love spy stories so much, of intelligence, counterintelligence, moles, etc., is because they are edgy all the way through. You're constantly, will you be exposed? You know, you could be killed at any minute, basically, this guy. So it's intrinsically tense. And I think they handle that tension very well. So yeah, I was gripped by it.
Also, great tips to what to do in a hotel if you want to see if anyone's been snooping around.
True. He's really overly harsh to his daughters, or I would say.
Yes.
I mean, his daughter is a drawing... What?
I thought he was protecting her mostly from the mother. And then and in that instance which you're referring to, I think it's because he was worried about if that picture were found.
Well, that was my interpretation initially.
Yeah.
And until he... I thought that's why he was doing it, and I thought that would be revealed as a reason why he'd do it, but then he doubles down by just being a colossal twat.
Yes.
So I was like, oh, maybe you're just a dick.
Yes. Why, when was he a swear?
Well, what he then says when he did, it's like action.
He didn't need to do that.
He didn't need to say what he said.
All I would say is he was stressed out at the time.
That's no excuse.
Very stressed
I'm very judgmental about things like that. I'm like, no, terrible parent. I'm not having it.
Yeah, oh God, I mean,
oh my God, please do not get into
that. No, I agree with James. I found that a bit much that he was so
my sympathy for, I was like, come on, discover him, kill him.
Take him out.
KGB, get him.
Nothing like being a bit extreme.
Yeah. Didn't like that. Also, you know, poor daughter, like the haircut that he inflicted on her as well was borderline child abuse. So, you know, it was rough. I thought the spycraft in this sort of varied slightly. Like, on the one hand, as you were saying, like his hotel room stuff, like the paper in the door thing felt a bit basic. Basically, you know,
listen, if it works.
He's supposed to be like the head spy guy. Surely there's a better way of doing that. But hey, you know, like maybe they're classics are classics for a reason. I quite enjoyed the when he has a meeting with, I guess it's the CIA station chief, and the way they do that, the kind of meeting in the changing room thing. I thought that was kind of cool.
I really like that.
Yeah, that was very good.
That had its moments. I was moderately diverted.
Oh, James, come on.
But again, like, I didn't warm to him massively. He's a very stoic character. Like, he's a very, you know, flat, keeps all his feelings inside, no exterior displays of emotion.
Like Gary Oldman in particular.
Indeed.
And also, that's what you'd expect, right? You'd have to be like that.
But, like, you know, when they're telling him,
yeah, cuddly teddy bear,
mate, your cover's blown, you're about to be killed, he reacts with absolute stoicism to all things. Mm. So it's quite hard to work out what makes him tick or sort of figure out quite what's going on beneath the surface. And then, of course, there is the fact that I was genuinely quite confused by the chronology. Like, I was a bit like, I don't know what's happening at this stage. But that might have just been me just being confuzzled.
Mm. You've made me doubt now whether that days earlier thing did.
Yeah, you made it up.
Yeah,
if anyone watches it, let us know.
Interesting.
Well, we should mention this has aired elsewhere previously. I think it aired, I want to say, in the US on HBO last year, didn't it?
So, HBO Max. I think this is one of their I read some of their final productions from the version of HBO Max before they
became Max.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's very much an international co-production, including America, with a lot of American money in it. Yeah, it was on America. Got really good reviews on American TV.
Yeah.
And it's going to be, should I tell you when it's on, James?
Yes, it's on BBC Four, which is in fact a real channel.
Yeah, BBC Four, and it's in their traditional Saturday night foreign language drama slot that Kay particularly loves.
That's why I stay on a Saturday.
Yeah. So it's on Saturday, 4th of May, BBC Four, 2024, 9 p.m, and it'll all be on the iPlayer that very evening as well, I believe. There you go.
Excellent. Next up, we have Shard Lake on Disney Plus, which is based on the series of historical novels by C.J. Sansom and is set during the time of Henry VIII and sees crime-solving barrister Matthew Shard Lake on a mission to dissolve the monasteries. Boydie, please roll up your green sleeves and tell us, is this a show you'd like to see more of? Is it on a par with other great historical thrillers? And I can think of no other puns that match Henry VIII's Wives, so I'm going to stop there.
Oh, is that what you were doing?
Cool. Yes. Jane Seymour, Catherine Parr, come on, keep up.
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
Clearly you've not seen Six.
No. What was the... it's just struck me what this was a bit like. Literally now, as I was thinking about what this show was like, what's the, you know, the medieval crime drama film with... The Name of the Rose. You know, The Name of the Rose was Sean Connery.
Wait, medieval, you mean set in the 70s? According to James.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop you there, Kate. That is a Pilot Plus gag and therefore will not fly on the regular show. Yes, this also has big monk energy.
Big monk energy. Mm. So yeah, Name of the Rose was a really good film. Not one of my favourites, but it's a good film.
It's hard to keep a track.
Which is an investigation into a murder involving monks and stuff like that. And this is based on a series of novels by C.J. Sansom. I haven't read any of them. Have you?
No, James? I have never.
Because you do like a novel series, don't you?
I do, but I like fantasy novels. I don't really read, you know, historical.
So yeah,
fiction.
Fact isn't enough for you.
No,
fact me up. So this is set in 16th century England when Thomas Cromwell was busy kind of dissolving monasteries because Henry VIII was kind of like getting involved with the Catholics and stuff like that, and Cromwell wanted to stop them, and he was power hungry. So he's like hell bent on getting rid of them, and one of Cromwell's commissioners is murdered right at the start of the show, of the story, in a monastery in the remote town of Scarnsey, and he gets local lawyer Matthew Shardlake of the title, played by Arthur Hughes, who was in that one-off drama Then Barbara Met Alan, which was about disabled campaigners, and they get him to investigate, and he's forced to take on a sidekick played by Anthony Boyle, who's recently been in Masters of the Air and lots of other stuff, called Jack, and together they set out to find out why the hell this guy was killed. And you get to see Thomas Cromwell, played by Sean Bean, looking like he's having a riot of a time, I have to say, in elaborate...
Oh, yeah, Beano's loving life.
Beano's loving it in his elaborate period costume. It deals with kind of like issues of the time of, you know, what it was like. There's only one major female character played by Ruby Ashmore Circus who works at the monastery, and she's a very, I would say, modern woman. Like, she comes across as like the kind of woman you'd expect to be, the way she deals with men and her dialogue, etc., in the 21st century rather in the 16th century. But it's, you know, if you're only going to have one female character in your show, you might as well make them a good, interesting, funny, well-scripted female character. And I thought Ruby Ashmore Circus was really good as her. It deals with, yeah, issues of disability, and of course the actor who plays the main role, Shard Lake, Arthur Hughes, is disabled himself. So that's like, you know, it's not so long since any disabled character on TV or film was played by someone who wasn't disabled with any disabilities. So that's a very important bit of casting detail, I think. And he's really good as well. I think the character is charismatic. He takes no shit from anyone, including his forced psychic, played by Anthony Boyle, as I said. And it deals with sexuality among the monks, and you know, there's a kind of question mark as to why, what are they all kind of scared of stuff. They're all scared of being exposed, of having, you know, beneath the religious order that they're part of, the kind of secrets and lies that that entails, and that's quite interesting. I thought it was, it's only a four-parter. I assume this is going to, you know, they'd like to carry on making other four-parters of C.J. Sansom novels, because there's loads of them. There's loads of Shard Lake novels. But I thought it was decent. I feel a little bit about it how James said he felt about the Spibe thing. I didn't love it, but I thought there was enough in it to warrant, you know, kind of persevering.
Oh, I enjoyed
it.
Do
you love it? Okay.
Well, I enjoyed it because I enjoy that period of time, but also...
Medieval times.
Ye olde times. But also, I really liked it because of Arthur Hughes's performance, and also his kind of chemistry with Anthony Boyle.
Yeah,
because together they're like this mismatched couple and duo trying to, you know, embark on this mission, and they just have they're constantly like bickering at each other, sparring, plus become love rivals, if you will, over Ruby Ashbourne Circus's character Alice. And as you say, it's really interesting because Arthur Hughes is disabled himself. He's playing this character who in Tudor times was sort of mocked openly because of his scoliosis, and it deals with all that and the fact that, you know, it affects his confidence with the fairer sex. So it explores all that. And I just think that's really interesting because I haven't seen that a lot in, you know, a mainstream drama like that. He also has spoken about it and said, you know, to have a character that is clearly disabled, but it's one of the least interesting things about him. And I think it's true. But yeah, I'm just really interested in that dynamic of those two men on that mission. And also this, obviously, a love triangle adds an extra dimension to it. So I liked it. I thought it was a good period drama.
I honestly was more interested in the wider setting than I was about the plot of the show, like the dissolution of the monasteries. So when Henry VIII essentially turned against Catholicism and started dismantling the sort of papist infrastructure in England, which is kind of, that's the backdrop to this. But this is, you know, on the face of it, kind of a bit of a murder mystery, but that's the politics going on beneath it. The murder mystery didn't suck me in at all. I found most of the characters sort of borderline irritating. Like, I wasn't like hugely fond of them, but I really liked the monkiness. Like, the monkey business, 100% here for it. But the rest of it, less so. So, you know, who's the mysterious monk in the gallery who won't say anything but is watching everything? Like, what's going on, you know, beneath the surface of the monastery? Are they going to find a way to, you know, accuse the monastery of, you know, whatever it is they want to accuse them on? Because Henry VIII ultimately wanted to seize the monastery and dissolve it. Like, all of that stuff was really good, but I didn't like Shard Lake as a character. I didn't really sort of gel with men. I found him, well, I mean, by design, he's quite abrasive, right? Like, he's quite abrasive, he's quite obnoxious.
Shard Lake.
You know, yeah, he is. Like, I think he's got his heart's in the right place. Like, he definitely sort of like, you know, puts up the good fight. He sticks up for one of the monks who's being abused by another monk. But equally, he comes across to me as a bit of a bellend. And, you know, that doesn't disqualify him from being an excellent barrister and investigator. But when you also combine
that
with, when you combine that with like a murder where I wasn't particularly invested. I don't know who the person who was murdered was. He apparently knew him. I didn't. So, you know, I was like, whatever. So wasn't that interested in that. And I don't think they really found a way, certainly in that first episode, to make the murder compelling in and of itself. I think, you know, again, they you're curious, like, what is this mad monk at dinner who like tries to stab him and is like, you know, going berserk and is very anti-monarchy. You know, that's interesting. Babu Cisse, who's obviously great as the abbot, you know, that, like, his role in it, because he plays his cards very close to his chest, quite enjoyed that. Like I say, all about the monk stuff, but less so the Shard Lake stuff. So it's fine.
Yeah, I kind of agree about the crime not being that involving, and they didn't quite spend enough time setting up why we should be that interested in it, as opposed to The Name of the Rose, wherein the crime is really interesting. I seem to remember, if I keep referring to other films, as opposed to the shows we're reviewing. But I think it's fair enough in this case, because it is a similar vibe. It definitely is a similar vibe to Name of the Rose. And I think, yeah, I agree. I agree with James about the murder. Sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Don't apologise to me. Apologise to Shardlake.
Well, I like Shardlake, the character. I disagree with him. I know what you mean, but he's. I think he earns the right. I think you get the sense that he's earned the right to be a bit spiky.
He's definitely had a hard time. There's a very particular point where you see him as a flashback. Yeah. You love a flashback as a boy.
And an interaction
with a priest. Yeah, that kind of interaction, but silly. And it's just that. And so you get the sense that this is something that has dogged him his entire life. That was a good scene.
That moment, mm. yeah, it was powerful.
Yes. Well, Shardlake then, Monkey Business, which airs on Disney Plus. When, Boydie?
Disney Plus, Wednesday, the 1st of May, 2024. I just remembered, you know, it suddenly struck me. You know, the person who I think pointed out that we needed to remind people when shows are on. Mm. But he also wanted to mention at the beginning of the review. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
That was one of the things. So that's
which
actually...
I always do.
Did you? Know?
Every
sure?
single one, I always say what channel it's on.
No.
Did you say that?
I say what channel it's on.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Oh. Always say what channel it's on.
Oh my God, isn't that awful? We're actually sitting with him. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, it's the kind of thing he would do.
It is true. That is absolutely accurate.
It's a
accurate.
Classic zone out.
I can confirm it's on Disney Plus.
It is on Disney Plus, yes. Finally, we have Series 2 of The Responder, which, as we already know, was created by former Liverpudlian copper Tony Schumacher, who we heard from earlier, and is loosely based on his experiences working the night shift in Merseyside. Kay, would you like to be our first responder on this one, or to once again quote Peter Serafinowicz in The Gentleman, are you going to be a fucking chicken?
Oh, God.
Wow.
Oh, if only you could be locked up for that. Mm. Yes, I will be the first responder. Obviously, this is a fantastic show, and it was a massive hit. When was Series 1? Was it in 22?
22.
Yeah. Right, 22. Yeah. Okay, so, well, as Series 2 picks up, so Chris is... He's having a hard time. I mean, Chris is always having a hard time, played by Martin Freeman. He is now dealing with the fact that his estranged wife, played by Mianna Burring, is potentially going to get a job in London, which would mean that his daughter, Tilly, is taken away from him and he can't cope with that. So he is sort of going all out to try and get a day job. He wants to get out of being a first responder and he wants to forge a new life so that he can spend more time with his daughter. But it's not going to plan. And while he's trying to avoid all kind of the illegal activities and the underhand stuff that went on in season one, he's very quickly drawn in again. On the promise that he can get a day job. So that's where we find him. Also, he's now... So Rachel, his former partner, is now working alongside a new character called Eric, played by Ian Pulliston-Davis, who's a very different kettle of fish to Chris. But ultimately, she does kind of miss the adrenaline provided by Chris's shenanigans. And so they end up pairing up again, but at what cost? And that's what we're going to learn. As always, it's incredibly tense. And we always say, I mean, I always say this, but Freeman's Liverpudlian accent, unlike James's, is so superb.
Our accents are indistinguishable.
You could be as understudy.
Freeman did say, we cut out of the interview, but he did say, by the way, you know, thanks for the compliments about my accent, but it's not as good as James's.
Did it at any point ask you to be a fucking chicken?
He didn't, but I thought, well, let's cut that out. It's a bit indulgent.
But it's just so good, isn't it? The storytelling is excellent, and as are the performances. And I just think this time around, also, you get to see more of Chris's, like, you get to see his dad, and you kind of explore their relationship. You see why Chris is how he is, and how he, when under fire and like really back against the wall and needing help, he has to turn to his dad, who actually has a really difficult, fucked up relationship with.
His dad played by Bernard Hill, who was in The Boys of the Black Stuff.
I think you mean King Theoden of Rohan.
No, I don't mean that. yes, that as well. But a legendary figure, particularly in Liverpudlian thespian activity. Carry on.
I just think it's. Yeah. I think it's brilliant.
It is so good, and it's one of those shows. It's almost hard to pinpoint why it is so good. I think the right is, you know, Tony Schumacher. This was his first TV script. You know, he'd done novels before. I think a couple of novels. Absolute kind of object lesson in how to tell stories that are quite intimate little, like, for example, here's an example of what, like, in the first series, there's this kind of two of the younger characters, Emily Furness, Casey, who was the initial spark for the whole story in a way, because she nicked some drugs from the local crim, and he was worried about her safety and her welfare,
Chris,
and so he got embroiled in this whole world when he was trying to do the right thing by this vulnerable young woman. She's back in this series, and she's still, like, she's such a vivid character. And she, and her mate, who's played by Josh Finnan, Marco, he's back as well. And they're like a double act, the way they bounce off each other. And they're really funny, and kind of, but they're both dealing with kind of incredible hardship as well. And his girlfriend is just given birth to his kid, and I thought the scenes where she's off, like, being arraigned in court basically and probably going to end up in jail, and he has to look after his newborn child, and just those moments, the depiction of that, him not even thinking about it and just like, oh, the mum's going to look after it, it's fine, and then being literally landed with this baby and not
left
having
holding
any,
the baby
left hold, literally left holding, and not having any idea about nappies, feeding, no concept, no clue, and it's so brilliantly done, like that little subplot, really, if you like, not, you know, from the main action. It was so fantastically done. The dialogue, the acting, the scene.
It feels like Happy Valley in that way, right?
Yeah, right.
That everything is considered.
Yeah, it's got Happy Valley-ish. Yeah, Sally Wainwright kind of. Just so, and his dialogue is just a little bit, you know, a little bit kind of, it's completely grounded in realism, but it's also funny and witty, and it's got, like, you know, when you think it's entering into the dark depths of misery of these night shifts that this poor guy has to do, something, he'll say something or someone else will say something that's funny that undercuts the whole thing. And I think that's really important because it is fairly grim. A lot of this stuff is really, really grim. As you say, Bernard Hill, his dad's got issues with his dad, and he can barely deal with the fact that he has to see his dad, and it comes as a surprise to him. And then he has to deal with, and the way he kind of gets embroiled in criminality, but on the edges of it, and is constantly trying to pull back, constantly trying to work out, can he avoid these corruption, you know, that is clearly stinks and clearly, you know, is all around him. Can he somehow remain pure because he's desperate to make sure that Mina Brewing, his wife, doesn't go to London and take his daughter.
I know. It's so agonizing.
It's agonizing and brilliantly poised and fantastically well conceived. And I watched episodes 1 and 2. Which they sent me to. And episode 2, because episode 1 kind of reminds you of all the characters brilliantly, by the way.
Oh, it does. Gets a great recap, speed. Doesn't it?
Great recap. Adelaide Adedayo, didn't mention, as his partner, who in start with in series 2, is happy to be away from him. Then she realises that actually he's the fun one rather than a boring new partner. And it's not, and he gets her back to help him. He gets embroiled on a whole new criminal enterprise storyline. And in episode 2, it builds and builds and builds to a point where he's got his cop car is full of people, and I won't say who they are, I won't spoil it. And he's investigating this mysterious vehicle in the docks of Liverpool. And the whole thing is like almost borderline farce, like too many people in his car to deal with, like family, enemies, villains, bosses, everyone's like, and he has to deal with this whole thing, and it just builds up to a brilliant.
I love how he deals
climax.
With stress, yeah. Right?
Oh, fantastic. So, yeah. It's just brilliant. It's kind of the role of his career. I mean, you know, this, you're talking about Martin Freeman, absolute legend in The Office, let alone Breeders, let alone Sherlock. You know, what a brilliant series of characters he's had to play in his career. But I think this is the best because he transforms himself, doesn't he? It's like, and he's got like a cropped hair in this series, and the accent, as you say, is brilliant. But I just think he physically transforms himself into a completely different human being from who Martin Freeman really is. It's like his tension is like in his body, isn't it? It's constantly kind of like a
he's
ticking
constantly
time
on the
bomb.
Edge.
Yeah, he's constantly on the edge. Exactly. Mm. That's the best way of putting it. So I absolutely love it. I think it's brilliant.
So I never finished series 1 of this.
Doesn't surprise me.
No. But actually watching this, I was like, God, this really is very, very good, isn't it?
Yeah.
For all the reasons you say, but I also very much enjoy the fact that there's a bit in there where a character just turns to him and says, you know, and they kind of look at him, they're kind of wincing like, well, I mean, everyone thinks you're a knobhead.
Yes, it's like, that's a brilliant
you know that, right?
That
was, yeah. Like, you that know so, that.
And also how accepting of
yeah.
it was.
And yeah. he's like, yeah, you're yeah. right. Everyone yeah. thinks I'm a knobhead. And
I
just
that.
Thought, it's an excellent moment because it's that he understands what we, the audience, understand, that he is a bit of a knobhead.
Mm.
But he's a very organic knobhead. And you just totally get who he is. I like that. And also there's a moment in this where a bunch of policemen converge on a suspect who then arms himself with dog poo.
Yes, oh
and
God.
I just thought that was such a genius moment.
Yeah.
Because, and I imagine, I don't know if you spoke to Tony Schumacher about this, but that feels like something's been drawn from experience. It feels like that's a thing that's happened.
Yeah. Never but use again, poo as a weapon of
but,
fear.
But the fact is, the second he sort of lifts up the poo, the police, who have like pepper sprays and they've got their bats, they're all like, whoa, you know, back right.
It's such
like,
a great scene.
Stay away from us with the poo. And I just thought, that's just so, it felt so real, that did. That 100% felt like something that has happened.
The authenticity is incredible. Yeah.
Really, really good. Really great characters, you say. They all feel very sort of, and coming to this, not remembering who anyone was, having only seen one episode of the first series, I felt like I understood who all the players were within a few minutes of watching this.
Yeah. Also,
because it feels very well rendered.
I really liked how they are still exploring what happened to Rachel and, you know, the after effects.
Yeah. She had an abusive boyfriend.
Yeah,
that and the catch up on that was quite upsetting.
Yeah.
And that kind of reminded me why I didn't persist with the first series.
Yes, but I'm surprised you made it this far, to be honest, because it's very much stuff that you can't normally deal with.
But it felt like a lot of that was glossed over in the previously on The Responder, so that was good.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah,
but yeah, that was nasty stuff. And obviously, she's now, as you say, that's a continuing thread, but takes on a new dimension in this second series.
And her abusive partner is played by Philip Barantini, the director of A Boiling Point and other things. He's like, it's really interesting. Yeah. There you go. Sorry, nothing else to say about that.
It's a good fact.
Yeah, it's a good fact, Boydie. The Responder then, which is on BBC One, when?
It is on BBC One Sunday, the 5th of May, 2024, at 9 p.m.
9 p.m. Anything else out this week that we have not been able to cover, Boydie?
Yes, the main show that we have not been able to cover due to a full embargo situation is The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which is a big old Sky drama launching on Thursday on Sky Atlantic. And now I think it's probably one of their biggest new shows of the year, I would say. Stars Jonah Howard King as a young Slovakian guy who's deported to the concentration camp Auschwitz, and he kind of falls in love with a young woman there, and the whole thing is told by the modern day version of the character, played by Harvey Keitel, no less. We can't review it. I was about to say what I thought of it.
It's embargoed, boy.
It's heavily embargoed.
We'll be discussing that on Pilot Plus.
We will be doing on Pilot Plus, exactly. That's the main thing.
Yes. Our much vaunted Constellation chat.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that on Pilot Plus as well.
Finish that at the weekend. Thank you. there's a show on Netflix on Thursday. This is what I call in the unheralded department of Netflix dramas. A Man in Full, Netflix on Thursday. It stars Jeff Daniels, no less, as Atlanta real estate mogul Charlie Croker, who faces sudden financial ruin. It's adapted by David E. Kelly, and I'm going to say no less again, of Big Little Lies fame, from the 1998 novel by Tom Wolfe. No less, because Tom Wolfe is a huge legendary novelist as well. And it's directed by Thomas Schlamme of the West Wing fame.
Yes.
No fucking less. And Regina King, exactly the same, no less, of One Night in Miami. And yet, I have not heard a peep out of Netflix about this fucking show. I found it on their like website and stuff.
Consider him outraged.
It's weird. So furious. Who knows what is the story, but it's embargoed, but hopefully we'll get to see it soon. That's on Thursday on Netflix. But I made it clear.
On Saturday, May the 4th, Star Wars Tales of the Empire drops on Disney Plus, but we have not had episodes of that to see at this juncture, unfortunately.
No.
This is a follow-on from Star Wars Tales of the Jedi.
Yes. I think that...
Wait, did you say Welcome to Wrexham?
Oh, no, I didn't say Welcome
Friday
to Wrexham.
Friday the 3rd.
Yeah.
Come Disney on, Plus.
Yeah.
Boy
day. Sorry, yeah, new season. Friday the 3rd, Disney Plus, exactly. And you know, also launches on Friday. I'm sure this will be covered on the Empire podcast, because it is officially a film, is Jerry Seinfeld's film, Unfrosted, which I wrote
about. It's about Pop-Tarts.
It's about Pop-Tarts, which I wrote about for Empire magazine. I got to interview the legendary man himself. But I'm sure you covered all that on the Empire podcast. I'm sure you will.
I'm sure we will.
Yeah. But it's on Friday on the Netflix.
Do we have a pick of the week?
Oh, The Responder.
The Responder.
The Responder, yes.
We're all in agreement.
We are all in agreement there. That is it. That is it also for this week's show. If you enjoyed it, please do head on to Apple Podcasts and leave us a Britain's Biggest Penis rating. and if you'd like to follow us on social media, we are at Caribero, at Boyd Hilton, at James C. Dyer, and at Pilot TV Pod. On next week's show, we'll be back in the world of elite sci-fi on Apple TV Plus for Dark Matter. Is it coincidence that Kay has chosen that week to take a week off? Who knows? Possibly not. But we will be reviewing that. Bodkin drops on Netflix as well. And, of course, the one and only Doctor Who, which Boyd is off to see this very moment.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there will be other things that we'll be watching as well.
Inside Number 9, final series.
Who is it? Is that next week as well?
Yeah. Oh,
amazing. See, I didn't know that. You know why?
It's not on the calendar.
It's not on the calendar.
I'm a busy man. I'm watching 9 episodes of Shogun.
Yeah, and you got to watch Constellation on the weekend.
Oh, God, exhausting.
Amazing. Right. Okay, that's it. We're done. We're finished. We will see you on Thursday for Pilot Plus when we'll be delving into The Tattooist of Auschwitz. If you do not subscribe to Pilot Plus, what is stopping you? It is a bargain prize at $2.99 a month, for which you get an extra show a week. You get us wanging on about stuff. You get the post bag. You get our From the Vault retro specials. You get spoiler specials. So much good stuff. Plus, you get the regular podcast like 12 hours early and ad-free, crucially, as well. So, sign up. Go on. Please. Pilot out.